We are talking with Jiva Singh Anand and Joseph Weggs about the Bavarian Illuminati and the historical society, who they were, where they came out of, what the political climate at the time was, and of course, where they're going. In this segment, we're going to get into a little bit more into the rituals, some of the translations, and a lot of other interesting gems that we're going to discuss here. But let's just do a pass over on some of the points here first. I wanted to ask you guys about some of the other literature then that came out at the time, and of course you guys have mentioned it already a little bit. For example, Augustine Birrell wrote the memoirs illustrating the history of Jacobinism. We had Alexander Horne, a Scottish Benedict monk who allegedly came to influence Birrell indirectly, I believe, and also then John Robinson, who you know, kind of connected some of the dots as well. Between the Jacobin and you know, Jacobinism and everything else. And then extension, we have a little bit further ahead, someone like James H. Billington, who wrote The Fire in the Minds of Men. Jiva, if we begin with you, what do you make of this literature that's coming out, which is, of course, is taking this conspiratorial view? It's they're trying to argue that the tenets of the Illuminati is subversive and goes against, you know, God and, you know, the monarchy and everything else. Is there any truth to these allegations, would you say, Jiva?
That they were against monarchy, yes. But again, I think Joe already pointed out that monarchy was going to be eliminated by raising humanity to a moral and intellectual level. Were monarchs and governments eventually wouldn't be needed anymore, and so they'd pretty much go away on their own, not through violence and bloodshed and things like that. They were definitely not atheists, although they did oppose the, they felt that Christianity as it was at the time had become debased through various politics, organizations, and additions. And so Christianity, they felt, had kind of fallen from what it had been in the beginning, that the original spirit of love thy neighbor as thyself had basically disappeared, and that the advent of that Christianity had actually devolved into a theocracy, which ended up being a tyranny, not only in a material sense, but also in the spiritual and intellectual sense. In fact, in one of the degrees, Weishaupt outlines, chronicles his own version of how tyranny, or what he calls despotism, evolved from kind of like this Edenic state, this idyllic original state of man in the Garden of Eden. And basically, not only was political tyranny bad enough, but in political tyranny, well, you couldn't do as you please anymore. But now you have this whole theocracy put on top of that, this whole layer of theocracy. And at this point, you can't even think as you please anymore. And that was what they opposed. And again, Weishaupt had some very bitter experiences. And I want to point out at this point that I am not anti-Jesuit. I am not anti anything, anyone that holds their, I respect everyone's religious beliefs. So I'm basically talking, this is what Weishaupt felt based on his own personal experiences in being raised as in a Jesuit educational system, and also the politically and religiously repressive state of Bavaria at that time. So we're not necessarily talking about Jesuits as they are today. I don't want to get the impression across that I'm some sort of Catholic basher or Jesuit basher or anything like that. We're talking about historical conditions.
Right, right. Definitely got that. Now, they do have mention of Adonai and the great architect in their rituals, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, it stems then from a, would you guys compare it to, just so we can ask you, this would stem very much from an equal belief in God, like let's say the Freemasonry has, that you have to believe in a higher being, a God, right? No matter how you actually, you know, visualize or what you call it. Would that be correct?
That would be correct.
So where do you guys think this notion come that they were atheists from?
A lot of it was applied to, like, from Barlow's book and also from Robeson's book, mm-hmm. Where they tie the excesses of the French Revolution, because there was a huge, there was kind of a revolution within the revolution, starting in 1792, going into 1793, and it's what kind of brought about the terror, de-Christianization of France, where they take the cathedrals and turn Notre Dame into the Temple of Reason, and things of this nature. And it's basically like, you know, it was all conducted like within a hyperinflationary environment. So basically, the most radical people of the day, the more radical, the better. And you had different revolutionary like papers and things like that espousing these type of ideas. So when it leads to the terror in 1793, and like, you know, all these people, I mean, just countless people lose their lives just on suspicion, because the Committee of Public Safety has basically gone raving mad at this point, or just, you know, anyone they even conceive that might be a threat, they go and they basically execute them. And so it's through these excesses like that they're characterized, and the reason they're characterized this way is because of those two books in particular.
And the Reign of Terror that is enforced in France at the time has nothing to do with some of the doctrines of the Illuminati.
Oh, not at all. Like I was saying earlier, yeah, there was like the two major factions, the Girondins and the Jacobins. The Jacobins were they were the radicals, and they killed the Girondins. And like, if the Illuminati could be characterized as anything, they would be characterized more in line with those guys' view, because, you know, they were of the opinion that, you know, man's original state, when he was without indispensable need of anyone or anything, he was truly free. But as things progressed, and a lot of this idea comes from Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin of Human Inequality. And if you haven't read that one, I recommend it, because it kind of gives an insight into what Adam Weishaupt was really thinking. And it's a philosophically unsound argument that he makes in the paper, but ultimately it's the major influence for this line of thinking that, you know, man starts out truly free, goes into bondage, and now they want to deliver him to freedom, but not through any violent means, but through enlightenment, education, promotion of wisdom, virtue, truth, reason, you know, things like this.
So let's get into a little bit on what the actual rituals of the Illuminati was then, and also maybe we can talk briefly about how they were, you know, how they were formulated. I guess, again, that's, as you guys already has clarified, it was nothing that just, you know, came out from Weishaupt, then it was like done and ready, and this was to follow. There seems to be a building period where a lot of things were developed, and again, it was when Knigge came in that a lot of things were kind of brought up to speed, if you will, and on par with some of the Freemasonic tenets. But what have you learned, guys, from the rituals of the Illuminati?
Well, one of the things that I learned was that by and large, if you started out as your basic Minerva, by the time you made it to the highest degree, there weren't any bad surprises. It wasn't like you're being innocently lured into this humanistic book club, and then once you read a certain level, it's like, surprise, now you worship the devil. everything very, very, very gradually and consistently builds on the next level. And at the very beginning, they told you, this is what our general vision is. And they also told you, the more work you put into it, the more talent and ability you display, the greater you are dedicated to the cause, the more we will reveal to you on a gradual basis. So basically, there's no surprises where you think you sign up for one thing, and then all of a sudden you find out that you're stuck in this thing that you can't get out of anymore. That was one of the things. And the other thing that I found out was that we're not talking about an occult or a hermetic organization. For example, if you compare it to, say, the system of the Golden Dawn, and Ezra Rogardi's book is out on the market, you compare the Illuminati degrees to the to the Golden Dawn system, there are basically no similarities, except for, you know, the occasional Adonai here or there. But we can definitely find, we definitely find out that they were not an occult or magical order. A lot of the folks in the OTO actually scratch their heads these days now that more information about the actual Illuminati is coming to light, and they wonder, where's this connection to these Illuminati? And it's one of the things that I'm wondering too. Now you can take a look at the Rex degree, which is the highest degree, and there Weishaupt has this very, very interesting metaphysical treaty where he kind of tries to reconcile the material world with the spiritual world. And he kind of uses a Neoplatonic argument. But if we're looking at the curricula of occult societies, that's not the stuff that you put at the end of the curriculum. That's not your most closely guarded secret. In an occult secret society, that's what you use as the hook to get people interested in your occult curriculum. So let's say this week, we're going to philosophically prove to you that yes, there is something out there other than what you can see with your five senses. Next week, we're going to talk about astrology. Then we'll talk about the tarot. And next month, we'll talk about conjuring spirits. So if they were an occult organization, they had it all backwards.
Maybe we can just talk about the structure a little bit here before we proceed. If you guys can clarify, you know, the degrees or how he was aligned pretty much, or how you would move through the hierarchy of the order.
Okay, so let me start out with that one. So like we said before, they started off with the novice degree. Then they developed the Minerval degree, then Illuminatus Minor, about the same point where Kniga comes in there, because Illuminatus Minor was originally called Minervalis Illuminatus. And so when Kniga comes into the order, they change it to Illuminatus Minor. Kniga writes the Scottish, or he takes the, there's a Freemasonic system that's working. He takes copies of the entire manuscript out of a Frankfurt lodge, and he basically steals 18th century York Rite masonry, and he changes it just enough to not get into trouble. And there's actually a good reason why he did that. But then from that point, he develops the Scottish novice, Scottish Knight, Priest, and Regent degrees. And so the classes are, the first class is the preparatory class that consists of Novice, Minerval, and Illuminatus Minor. Then the second class is the Freemasonic class. So you have your three symbolic degrees of Masonry, which are Master Mason, Entered Apprentice, Fellow Craft, Master Mason, and then you proceed on to Illuminatus Minor, or Scottish Novice, as they called it. Then the next one is Minervalis Dirigentes, which is directing Minerval or Scottish Knight, and that's the Freemasonic class. And so the last degree in each class rules over the category below it. So in the preparatory class, Illuminatus Minor basically are kind of the administrative staff for all the lower degrees. Same thing with Scottish Knight for the Freemasonic class, and then for the Mysteries class, Priest and Regent, they each had their different functions within the order, basically just kind of like, they run the whole province is how they would kind of divide different territories into Germany up. And so these two different positions ran those degrees. Now, that those were in the what's called the lesser mysteries. Then there's the greater mysteries. So like the Greek Eleusinian mysteries, consisting of lesser mysteries and greater mysteries, the lesser mysteries were totally developed by Kniga up to the regent degree. So we have, was it priest and then regent? And then from those two degrees, it goes magus and rex. And magus and rex, they were really never finished, and those were the product of Weishaupt. And what it was is he was trying to assert influence and control after Kniga's resignation from the order, trying to put his influence back into the order because, you know, Idem Weishaupt only developed the first class of degrees because he was incapable, him being not very advanced in Masonry, of developing the Freemasonic class. So Kniga reformed the Scottish, reformed the strict observance system in Scottish novice, Scottish knight, and the priest degree. So, like, the reforms to the old strict observance system are the reforms in those two degrees, and then the regent degree itself, he also wrote, but it was just as a side thing that was his own influence.
How many lodges is there? You know, can we speculate that it was tied to the Illuminati, and is it then fair to say that these were Freemasonic lodges to begin with, and then they were also used as Illuminati lodges, or was these completely separate, Joseph?
So basically, there was a thing where they were trying to get influence from the York Rite, and the York Rite was based out of Berlin at this point, and they were trying to get special dispensation to open up their own lodges. But the problem was back then, and also today for that matter, if you're trying to set up a new lodge, you have to go seek the Grand Lodge. Well, the Grand Lodge for Germany at this point is in Berlin, so they had to send a representative, the Marquis de Costanzo, up to Berlin to get some kind of agreement with them. But at this point also, because of Kniga, who he was, and his influence in the strict observance, they're able to take existing lodges initially and convert them over into Illuminati lodges. So basically the officers of the regular symbolic lodge, the Blue Lodge of Craft Masonry, first three degrees, they want to put their leaders in these positions. That way they can have their secret chapter, who are also the same officers, to confer the Scottish novice and Scottish knight degrees. And it starts out that way, but he ends up getting into some kind of, he gets crossed with someone on the way up there. And so the York Rite, not only will they not give him a reduced price for new charters for lodges, it causes a whole schism within the system to where they basically say, okay, fine, we're going to have the right to confer degrees and also issue charters based upon our own selves. So they basically broke with all like existing Freemasonic systems and set up their new one because of this this dilemma they had. And so they basically say, like in the ritual, that, you know, these are true lodges. And basically they were reforming like all the different occult type practices that were going on in Masonry at this point. And a lot of that stuff was more so in France and the Alsatian region, but you know, there was still some influence within Germany, and what they saw there, Kniga wanted to do was reform Masonry from being like focused on the occult sciences and this type of thing to observe more or less the correct proper founding for modern speculative Masonry as in the Grand Lodge of 1717 when it's formed in London, and from that kind of vein. And so that's why he copies the York Rite lodges, because one, he doesn't want to change anything because in his opinion that's true authentic Masonry. But on the other hand, you know, because they can't get any kind of special dispensation from the Grand Lodge of the York Rite of Masonry in Berlin, he essentially, you know, is forced to say, okay, well, we have the authority to charter these lodges. So initially, it was like kind of a conversion, and then basically they just started issuing their own constitutions and charters once they had a total break with the York Rite. So they kept running York Rite ritual in the symbolic degrees, but they also say to be careful of admitting people from different systems into these, and basically so they don't learn of our secret thing, not because we're doing like evil secret work and we're plotting in the shadows or anything. It's that it's irregular, Masonically speaking, to not have a properly issued charter, and you know, some of the oaths and obligations that you would take would forbid you from visiting these places. So that's why they need a secrecy, because it, you know, regular Masonry doesn't want to, you know, get crossed in any way with any type of things of these nature, and that's the reason why.
So they were, you know, they were not seeking to be accepted lodges in that regard, and they eventually kind of started to more or less set up their own Grand Lodge then, I guess. That's how we could kind of interpret it. Was it successful in spreading to other countries as well? Joseph?
Well, when they broke initially, there was 121 lodges that went with him, scattered throughout Germany. As far as their reach and influence, like I mentioned before, like with respect to France, and like by early 1782, you know, they started in the Alsatian region, particularly in Strasbourg, they started picking up lodges there. And they really didn't get any of the Parisian lodges until like 1787. L'Ami Réuni was the first one. But also one of the members in that lodge, at least that I had member list for, was also a member of the Lodge of the Nine Sisters. But he wasn't a very high-ranking person at all. He just happened to be a member of that lodge, because back, you know, then and even today, Masons will have different memberships and different lodges. And, you know, he might be a member of several lodges. That doesn't mean he's an active member there. His home lodge is L'Ami Réuni, but it's not. But he's at the Lodge of the Nine Sisters. So, you know, he just as kind of like a visiting brother or something like that.
I see. Now, Weishaupt fled in 1785 out of Bavaria. What was the reasons for that, and what happened to Weishaupt eventually?
Weishaupt, Weishaupt fled for several reasons. One, he lost his job at the University of Ingolstadt. Then later it became a lot of the known Illuminati leaders were arrested. Some of them served some pretty hefty prison sentences. And then in 1786, it actually became a capital offense to recruit for the Illuminati. After he fled to Gotha, Saxony, he was a guest of Duke Ernst II, and that's basically where he spent the rest of his life. And he wrote books on philosophy, and that's basically how he spent the rest of his life in relative obscurity. Every once in a while, somebody would would start another scandal, another lurid scandal about the Illuminati, and that's basically when he found himself in a position to defend himself. But that's basically, and toward the end of his life, he was pretty much shunned by everyone in the town that he'd moved to, because one of the things, number one, he was a pretty notorious person at the time, justifiedly or unjustifiedly. That's something that people will have to decide for themselves. Also, he was apparently he was one of those people that he just could not stop talking about politics. He was one of those political bores that once he'd found a willing ear, he would just talk your ear off about politics.
Now, let's talk a little bit about what happened, because this is around the same time that when Weishaupt flees, we have that curious situation of Johann Jakob Lantz, I believe it is, that actually is, he dies by lightning in July of that year, while he's on his way to Regensburg, if I remember that correctly. What happened in that scenario? And that's also when the documents becomes known, correct? And that's really when things kind of, they start go out and hunt for the Illuminati, correct?
Yes. Lantz was a courier who was supposed to deliver important documents to Regensburg, and he was struck by lightning. Weishaupt actually saw that happen pretty much right next to him, and he fled the scene. And that's basically where a lot of these allegedly conspiratorial documents came to the attention of the authorities.
And clarify that a little bit more. Alleged. Do we know what documents were found on Lantz?
I'm going to pass that question on to Joe.
Sure.
Oh, thanks, buddy. specifically, I don't know exactly what documents were found on him. Now, I will say one thing as far as like their conception of secrecy and why it might be even a necessity. Is that in some of the political discourses, like in the Freemasonic class degrees, where he starts, like specifically in the Scottish Knight degree, he starts talking about, you know, the whole purpose of secrecy in these institutions isn't that what they're teaching is inherently secret. It's that you know, some of the greatest truths and the most profound truths are simple concepts that if someone mentions to you in passing, like we take for granted the maxim, like absolute power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, you know, it's something we take for granted, right? But if you do it within the setting of like mystique and allure, it makes someone pay attention to everything that is said, because you know it's secret. It's, you know, well, you're in for some secret knowledge, and the whole reason for his constructing this was a means of like gaining someone's utmost attention and to ingrain inside them like that the importance and the magnitude of what he's saying, even though it might be a profoundly simple thing to say. It also talks in these documents that, you know, perhaps later in throughout time, as society and civilization becomes more enlightened and advanced, well, there won't even be a necessity or a need for these things. But, you know, as it is right now, that to communicate these truths, and like they were basically for like a political and a semi-religious reform, religious within the context of like freedom of religion, you know, freedom of expression, things we all take for granted today and things that are enshrined in the American Republic, you know, those were totally revolutionary for back then, because they were, but it's things that we take for granted today. And so the reason for the secrecy that a lot of people look at wasn't necessarily because it's a great profound secret, but it's a means of motivating someone because that, you know, I want to ascend to higher knowledge, I want to learn these things, they're secret, you know, there's not anything really secret there at all. It does profound truth that, you know, are communicated when you have your full attention to it.
Now, let's see here. A couple of more things I was thinking about as you guys have translated this. And does it say anything about, let's say, that if you join, for example, that you can or can't end your membership? Does it say anything about, again, if you do join, you can't, you know, speak anything about what goes on, initiations, rituals, etc., much in the same way that Freemasonry does?
Absolutely. What you were definitely, not only were you supposed to keep the proceedings of what happened inside the lodges secret, documents that your superiors would send you, you actually had to return them. You were not supposed to have anything in the handwriting of your superiors. Secrecy was basically their main thing. You weren't supposed to know a lot of people outside your own lodge. You weren't supposed to know a lot of the people that were of higher degrees or even of the degrees below you. Even within your own lodge, you were supposed to use caution when talking about things that you were working on behalf of the lodge. So yes, secrecy definitely was very important to them.
Let me ask you a little bit more here about the Baron Knigge's extensive questioning catalog that he has, that you've translated from addenda, you know, A, B, and C. These mm-hmm. are, you know, kind of secret instructions for those who are tasked with recruiting new members to the order. It's question for assessing the character of a candidate, you know, for his degree, so they end up in the right place, etc. But it's a ton of questions here, obviously, in these three addenda. And the question is, as I'm reading some of these questions, I'm like, all right, they're very concerned with obviously getting the right person and noticing the person where they can fit in, I guess, into the order as well. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's maybe glaringly obvious that they're also fearful of getting the wrong people into their own order. They have their own vetting process, which is very strict. Correct, Jiva?
Absolutely. And there was also another reason for those questions, because some of the higher degrees were actually research departments. So a lot of these questions were basically research questions. One of the things that they were very, very interested in was a study of psychology, and you could even say that they were probably among the first groups to pioneer the science of psychology.
Interesting.
May I jump in there one second?
Yeah, certainly, certainly. Go ahead, Joseph.
Okay, so one thing that's important to understand about the Scottish novice degree that we're talking about here, like when you look at those questions, right, at the top of the heading of that, it says, Nosce te ipsum, which means know thyself. That's the, remember we were talking about, like, the purpose and nature of secrecy is to communicate great and profound truths, no matter that they're simple, but to communicate them secretly so that you pay attention to them and they're ingrained in you. It's kind of it's a method of pedagogy. So what we're talking about is, at the top of this is nosce te ipsum, which means know thyself. So there are questions to know yourself better. And what the lesson that's being taught is to know yourself and from yourself to know others. So like when the passphrase with this watch, like when they would go into it, you would say nosce te ipsum, and then the answer is ex te nosce alios, which is from thyself know others. And that was the nature of the secret being communicated in this degree.
So Joseph, does this mean that the Illuminati at the time had extensive profiles on each person, both being interviewed and eventually becoming a member as well?
Absolutely, and it was for a means of like tracking one's progress throughout the system. Is he truly being enlightened, or you know, is he just kind of pretending or putting on airs? And it was a means of tracking one's progress throughout the system. Before one could be promoted, one would have to demonstrate, sufficient progress to be advanced to the next degree.
And have all these documents been found?
There's quite a bit of them left as far as the different reports, and also, monthly they would have to turn in, a letter, a previously say, and then, and so forth like that. So they would basically, they would list, certain things in these, and they would compile these into reports, and then the Scottish Knights would condense these reports for the prefect of the province, and it would basically say, here's what these people's grievances are. These people were advanced to this degree. It was just a means of like progress reporting throughout the system. And so it was kind of like an actuary type system like that, where they would track progress like that and be able to report the actual progress higher up in condensed forms.
Interesting. Now, how much material would you say in total is it that you guys have translated? And an extension to that would be, when you do you do it exactly word by word in every page, or do you try to compose it in a different way and even exclude things when you do?
Well, I try not to exclude things during the translation process. The thing is that a verbatim translation comes across as fairly clumsy. Part of it is because that people like Weishaupt wrote very long and complex compound sentences. So if you try to stick to, for example, the same punctuation, that's going to make for some very, very dry and difficult reading. And sometimes you can lose the essence of what he was trying to get across. So during my translation process, I tried to kind of unpack some of his longer sentence into something that is more digestible for contemporary readers. But as far as like skipping things is concerned, no, definitely not. And again, I also try to stick to the terminology that is known today, although sometimes things have to be translated literal. Weishaupt is it's not something that you would translate like you were to translate, for example, a technical document like a data sheet or something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, and the language is primarily German and Latin, I would guess?
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about some of the notable members there. As I said, I think with the Swedish coffin as that was found. It was up towards, where did I have that note? 1,000, was it 300 members or something like that in total eventually? So we can't run through all of them, of course, but maybe we can talk about each of you and see which some of the more notable and influential members were. We could run through a few. How about you, Jiva? What would some of the most influential members be?
I would say, as far as the German intellectual elite goes, probably Knigge was definitely one of the most influential, well-known members. Knigge, over 200 years ago, wrote on human relations, which is still today a standard on civil conduct in the German-speaking world. In fact, today the word Knigge is in German almost synonymous with civil conduct and good manners. Goethe, Germany's national poet, actually had the regent degree in the Illuminati. Mozart was an Illuminatus. And then also important philosophers like Herder and Christopher Miners as well. Pestalozzi, the famous educator, also was a member of the Illuminati. One of the things that's important to keep in mind is that they were not so much interested in recruiting the economic elite. In fact, they actually, in their instructions, they repeatedly warn against people that had been born into positions of wealth and power, because they would not be able to sufficiently empathize with the suffering and the needs of the common man. What they were interested in very much was the intellectual elite, the thinkers and the artists and the scientists and so forth.
Joseph, who would you add to that list?
I think Jiva hit it pretty good, except for also maybe Schiller, Schroeder, mainly those guys, but he pretty much hit all the high-ranking members, or at least the high-profile members that people might recognize. Now, these guys are, like Jiva said, like they're after the intellectual elite. They're not after the monarchs or the aristocrats or people like this. They're after like the intellectual common man.
There were a couple of aristocrats that joined as well, I believe. And again, I'm finding, I have just too much notes for this program here, so I'm getting lost in all of them. But we have a couple that joined, which is of course a little bit, interesting in that regard, since it was, many people have argued that certain, and again, this is more from the conspiratorial view, but certain aristocratic families got in on it because they also saw an opportunity in there to detopple others, etc. Maybe you guys can speak to whether that's true or not, but was it against the Illuminati to also bring in, royalty and aristocratic people into their ranks?
Not particularly. And like the connection and the source of that connection was Knigge. Like, remember, like I said before, he was a high ranking member of the Strict Observance. The Strict Observance was a very dominant system in Germany at this point. And so it was through that influence of people he's already associating with, people he might be attending conventions with. And so here he is. He's got a position of leadership in this new order that he's writing these degrees for, and yet they're selling this system as an old system, like a pre-existing system. So in a lot of ways, it was kind of farcical what they put on out there, and because he was trying to reform this system. So the ability and the accessibility of these people, serves a couple purposes. Really, is that one, they're associates of Knigge's, and then two, because they're high-ranking members in these Masonic systems within the realm of their power, they're able to expand influence in there. So, the reasons are manifold, but primarily, without Knigge, none of this could have happened.
Right. Yeah, it was Duke Ernst, the second of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, I think he was, but maybe that was later, actually, in terms of the... the transportation of the documents, again, I think out of Sweden or the Sweden box. But there was a couple other things here I wanted to ask you guys about when it comes to, I guess we can go into that right now in terms of their legacy and some of the revival attempts that happened as well, and what you guys think about that. We can begin with you, Jiva, in that regard. If there's any indication that they managed to live after that, they're said, some people have said that they've gone underground, and again, several revival attempts have been made. Where are we today when it comes to the Illuminati?
One of the things that I'd like to add real quick is that as I was going through all the documents, I interestingly was not able to find anything that could be neatly translated into New World Order. The literal translation would be Neue Weltordnung, and that I, in all these documents that I've looked at, all the documents that I've translated, that phrase just isn't there.
I looked for that one first too.
Yeah. As far as their legacy is concerned, they had their outlook was their vision was that was for a world that was unified, where people could talk with each other rather than wage war against one another. So if we're looking at things like organizations like, say, the United Nations, if they would work the way that they were supposed to, the way that they were intended to, just to provide a table where everyone can talk to, without all the corruption that we found there. So the basic idea of the United Nations would definitely be one of those things. And also other things like notions like, for example, truth and reconciliation, that you could look at that as one of the legacies, a general positive outlook toward the future. As far as revival attempts are concerned, the earliest revival attempt can be traced back to Leopold Engel and Theodor Royce at around 1880. Royce and Engel eventually parted ways because Royce wanted to pursue the founding of the OTO, and then Engel just kind of hung in there with his Illuminati for a couple of decades, and I believe right now there is like a tiny, tiny little organization in Switzerland that can claim direct lineage to Engel's Illuminati. Now, then you also have a whole bunch of revival attempts within the occult and esoteric community. They claim to be descendants of the Illuminati via some of the more esoterically inclined people in them. And then one of the things, and that is a very important point that Terry Melanson actually pointed out, is that the Weishaupt's Illuminati are often confused with a concurrently running spiritualist or spiritual esoteric movement called the Illuminés, and that was a French movement. And a lot of those organizations that have a legitimate claim to calling themselves Illuminati and that can actually trace the lineage all the way down to that time are actually descendants of the French Illuminés. And then, of course, you have a whole bunch of scam artists, and I can't stress that enough, that will tell you, that will send you these letters, these emails that say, hey, you know what, if you want fame, power, riches and all that stuff, call this number or send me this email. And I've actually, some of them have actually started spamming our website, and just to kind of let people know, hey, look, this is the racket that these guys are running. This is the type of email that they'll send you. And of course, I've taken out all the contact information out of those little spam mails. So that's basically what we're looking at in terms of what the legacy might be and what some of these revival attempts are.
What is the connection to the couple of other ones that did come up afterwards? We have the Alumbrados in Spain, Carbonari in Italy. Are any of these, have they anything to do with the Illuminati, do you think?
Not with the Illuminati. A lot of these actually go back to the esoteric French movements, actually.
I see. Now, Joseph, let's switch over to you a little bit. I wanted to ask you a little bit more. You mentioned kind of a little bit earlier about the story that the Illuminati kind of, there was an interest in trying to come over to America, set up lodges there and kind of start taking over stuff there. But what happened in America? And maybe as an extension to that, you can tell us a bit more about the Colombian Illuminati.
Absolutely. So what was going on, this is the period we're talking about is early June of 1780. And there was kind of debates going on within the Munich Illuminati about, we need to send some people over there to help them with the revolution. A lot of this stuff has been lost. We have fragmentary pieces left, and we also have secondhand accounts, in the years preceding World War I of researchers and scholars who've gone through these papers and kind of annotated some things like that. So we have some insight into what was there. But specifically, like using these correspondences, I was able to find letters that they wrote to Franklin and Adams while they were serving as envoys to Paris in 1780. And basically what they were wanting to inquire about was, could we get some land over here, a square mile of fallow land in a temperate, healthful country? Can we have entire liberty of conscience? Can we do this, that, and the other? And in exchange for this, we'll provide you as with useful people and this, that, and the other. And so they write to them, and they also send one letter to Philadelphia, which may or may not have gone to the Continental Congress. That one's lost, but I found the other two to Adams and Franklin. And so what they were wanting to do was come over here. And the name of the project was Elysium, because they saw America, like I said before, they were inspired by our revolution and not the other way around. They saw America as a place for freedom to basically enact the ideas they wanted here. And they wanted to, there's two towns that are basically gone now, but it was right off the Savannah River, Perrysburg, South Carolina, and Ebenezer, Georgia. And they're both right across each other from the same point on the Savannah River. And then further up the river, possibly even to Augusta, they're wanting to set up some kind of colony in these parts. But the problem is, while they're debating this, the British capture, in the Battle of Charleston, captured the southern half of the colony, so that pretty much kills their plan right there, not to mention the fact that they really didn't have any money. And that's one thing we see throughout the entire system, is because all these other different systems before had taken a lot of money, and it was really expensive to be a Mason back then. People were paying into this stuff for supposed knowledge and wisdom like that and weren't really getting very much out of it. And so as a reflex to that, they really didn't want to take hardly any money at the lower levels. And at the higher levels, you would give what you thought you could give. So consequently, they never had very much money to do this plan anyway. So they wanted to set up, like a schoolhouse, a farm. They even mentioned getting a couple servants, not that they were for slavery, but it was just very common back then to help them out to get their colony established. But ultimately, it was just a giant pipe dream anyways. But it leads over to there's a group going on with the Colombian Illuminati. Now, what that was, it all goes back to this guy named Elihu Palmer, and he was a graduate of Dartmouth. He's in all these different fraternal-type organizations, though he wasn't a Mason, and he tried to become a Mason, but when they found out that more of his views were more deistical, but like of the militant strain, where basically he wasn't tolerant of anyone and anyone that believed in Christianity or anything like that, basically he was totally oppressive with his beliefs. So it didn't win him a lot of friends. And so he tries to set up this deist debating club called the Universal Society. He announces in the paper he's going to give this lecture against the divinity of Christ. Well, that doesn't sit very well, so they run him out of town, and he works as a lawyer for a couple of years. Then they have this yellow fever epidemic in 1793. He's struck blind. His wife is dead, so he sends his kids off to live with his dad. and he travels around to Augusta, Georgia, of all places, Newburgh, New York, New York City, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and I think that's all the ones that I can remember off the top of my head. But he sets up all these clubs because, you know, as a blind guy who's a former minister, he's basically a sophist, and the only means he has of supporting himself is traveling around and trying to set up these clubs kind of in the fashion that he had before. He was also a member of the Democrat-Republican Society of Philadelphia, which was kind of like French-inspired. So when they have like claims, Jedediah Morse goes around and says that, oh, well, I know I've got proof that these French Freemasons, they set up here. Well, the thing was, he was not only a correspondent, but was friends at one point with Elihu Palmer, so he did have firsthand knowledge of this whole entire thing. It's just that, you know, basically this whole thing comes down to one guy traveling around a bunch of different places and probably being run out of town, to be honest, and, you know, kind of constantly being on the road and setting up these things because he's totally inspired by the French Revolution. Like in his early writings, he predicts the overthrow of the monarchy, like in 1788, you know, and if you kind of look back then, he's not really prophetic. If you look at the way things are going, you know, it's just kind of a natural reflex because they were, you know, harsh winter, you know, it's not a rocket scientist to figure out that when people are hungry that they're going to revolt. And so as a consequence, like, he was kind of ideologically inspired by the French Revolution. And so a lot of that kind of vein in America actually goes back to this one guy, Elihu Palmer. So when we look at Columbian Illuminati, what we're talking about is we're talking about the derisive term that was printed in a pamphlet about his club, the New York Theistical or Deistical Society, and that was one of his clubs.
Well, that's interesting. Now, is there any, this is a little bit later, of course, but, you know, someone like Robert Owen, let's say, or Owenism, or the Owenites, that they even set up, was it New Harmony up in Indiana? That's, again, it's a little bit later, but could there be any connection here in terms of some of the utopian ideals, Joseph? What do you think?
Well, I think philosophically, these ideas, you know, obviously predate the Illuminati. Like I said before, you know, Rousseau was one of Weishaupt's like biggest like sources of inspiration. You know, it was Rousseau's social contract, you know, that basically Robespierre was said to sleep with under his bed. And so kind of like, you know, different people of different philosophical and moral persuasions latch onto different ideas and see things differently. But inherently, the philosophy is the guiding source of all these things. And not that the philosophy is either good or bad. It's inherently just an idea. It's the application of these ideas that, you know, can lead to problems or can lead to good things. It's, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag, really. But as far as the specific case that you're talking about, I haven't heard much about that, to be honest.
Okay, all right. Okay, so we could say that the environment, you know, at the time in Europe, it's understandable. I mean, one of the very reasons that so many people from Europe wants to go over to America is because the conditions are not, they're not great. They are, in fact, horrible. You know, feudalism, you have extensive oppression and everything else. So the environment is understandable. They have a desire to break away, you know, from the monarchy and the kind of, you know, let them eat cake type mentality. But as you guys have been going through the documents and the rituals and everything else, Was all the measures that you would argue from your own, I guess, moral stance, were they all fine? There were nothing problematic. They were all benevolent. There were nothing that was, alluding to the fact that this was about, again, I mean, you clarified this already, that it wasn't about violence. But if we look at it from other points of view, was it all good ideas, I guess? And even if we looked at the end result of it, if their philosophy were to be implemented, however large they saw that to be, if it was just locally in a small area or if it was all over the world, was it within the confines of good ideas? Jiva, if we begin with you, what do you think?
By and large, yes. One of the things that we have to take a look at is that if we're looking at if we're judging their ideas by today's standards, they probably had some of their ideas probably had left something to be desired. But if we're looking at their ideas from the historical perspective, from the historical time in which they lived, many of their ideas were far, far ahead of their time. Some of their ideas that were probably not so good was that they had kind of a paternalistic attitude toward colonialism. Some of the methods weren't necessarily worse than what a lot of other people did. I've already addressed their whole hostile takeover policy. But if you look at their ideals and then compare some of the things did these actions live up to the standards that they themselves set? Then there are some questions that might arise, but they weren't certainly not any worse than anyone else in their time, and in a lot of respects, a lot of the ideas that they had then turn into freedoms and liberties that we take for granted today, and some of them are still some ideals that we might want to gun for. I mean, who wouldn't want to live in a society where there is no poverty, where there is no war, crime, murder, and where we don't have to feel like the government's breathing down our neck all the time? And I don't have a problem with our government, but the government that is so far in the background where you don't even think it exists anymore is something that I think is an admirable ideal to have.
Joseph, what do you think?
I tend to agree with Steve on that one. As far as, like, you know, maximizing individual personal liberty, I think these things, mm-hmm. you know, these are natural human inclinations. This is what people, you know, they want, really. And, you know, so from that perspective, yes, you know, like David also mentions, you know, there's some nuanced things like that where maybe I don't necessarily agree with everything they're saying or even their means and methodology for getting there. You know, particularly like in their system like that, like in their ritual, they say that, you know, maybe this isn't a new organization, or maybe this isn't an ancient organization, so pretend yourself as the founder like that. So it's basically like putting yourself from this perspective. So they're not exactly deceiving you that it's a new creation, but the way it's presented like that, it could be easily overlooked that, you know, that they're not, that this is not an authentic, genuine system of esoteric, you know, wisdom or however you want to approach it from that. So that might have been a bit disingenuous. And then also it's with regard to the hostile takeover policy, it doesn't apply to political or religious circumstances. It's specifically within Freemasonry. And the only reason that it even became an option is because they had a total schism with the York Rite up in Berlin. So that really didn't, it wasn't a result of their direct intentions like that, but it was kind of a result of what they, of playing the best card to the situation.
Now, Joseph, let me ask you this as well. And I want to ask you this from the point of view that I want to try to examine a little bit more if there's any, you know, suggestions that there's any kind of authoritarianism behind there. On one end, you have people saying that, all right, it's a precursor of pushing us, you know, more and more towards a radical, you know, left-wing ideology, which is eventually then going to lead us to socialism. And again, then on the other hand, you have this branch that's saying that Illuminati really is, it's another form of royalty. It's, you know, it's the bankers, you know, pretty much that kind of idea. But nonetheless, does it say anything within the writings about, you know, governing bodies and who would, you know, call the shots pretty much? How detailed is it in this regard, Joseph?
Extremely detailed. So in the Scottish Knight degree is basically, if we look at it from this perspective, like the Scottish Knight degree, a lot of the political discourses, the main point of the whole Scottish Knight degree is man governing himself. And one of the lectures, like I mentioned before, is a modification of a discourse on the origin of human inequality by Rousseau. Totally lifted from there, but there's large parts of it where you can definitely hear the same similarities in there. And that, of course, that went on later to become the social contract. But the point where they're the most similar is when he talks about like the origin of man, and like that man's, you know, inherently born free, but like through society as his needs become manifold, you know, basically they're saying that the means of control of one person over another is to place one person in their indispensable need. But should the table shift, that indispensable need goes to the other person, and so people are constantly exchanging back and forth between rule and oppression. So it's kind of like a practical philosophical perspective of, you know, how did we get to where we are without naming names and naming dates, but general concepts and ideas. It talks about the evolution of government. to lead you to the point where that man's natural state is freedom, and that man, you know, ultimately must return to this natural state, and that basically through their system is the means of achieving this. Whereas in the priest degree, it's more based on more of like a religious type of form, but not in the sense of like, you know, we've got this new religion. It talks about, and keep in mind, they were like in the decaying Holy Roman Empire, like major Catholic influence here. So within the context of this, they're talking about the original Christians, not like necessarily a Gnostic perspective. I guess it kind of sounds like it's Gnostic, but really what they're talking about is that Jesus taught different teaching or different lessons to his disciples. And what they're getting to the essence of is that the communication that was going on there was also the same political thing that man's natural state is freedom. And so it pairs with that idea. So it's more of like a supporting type system. Then we go all the way up to the Rex degrees, like where he's talking about all these things. He's doing it within the context of proving that the soul's immortal, there is a God, and there's something after life. But he does it through like a dialogue that kind of builds upon itself.
Interesting. So it's very much spiritually in that regard. It brings that component into it then. Yeah.
It's a very Christian type perspective, albeit like not a very mainstream Christian perspective from that point in time. Although maybe today it resonates with people. I'm not sure.
Interesting. Now, there's a couple of more questions I have for you guys, you know, before we round things off here, more kind of a lighter note, I guess. Well, one would be, just to preface this, it's obvious that a lot of people have projected what they want upon the Illuminati. And the question is, of course, how this simplification to a certain regard happened. I know that every time the Illuminati comes up, I've always tried to, you know, question a little bit more about, okay, tell us what you mean about that, because there are so many different ideas of what it is. So if someone, for example, talks about a conspiracy or even a new world order and happens to use the word Illuminati, it's not correct, but it might not be for, you know, malicious intents, if you know what I mean. They might just be that they use it as a word to kind of project onto it, or, you know, because people are familiar with it pretty much. But Jiva, if we begin with you, how do you think that this simplification happened, and what's the way out of that, do you think?
I think the important thing is to, I mean, you can always say that something is wrong in the state of Denmark, because we're human beings, we're imperfect, we have imperfect forms of government. But when we use the term Illuminati, we're actually looking at a very brief historical phenomenon. And that's basically kind of the way out of that. I mean, have there been conspiracies at high levels throughout history? Absolutely. We could go into countless examples. But, I mean, proving this master conspiracy, I'm still having a hard time wrapping my head around that concept.
Right, but you believe that there are conspiracies in the world?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
People conspire to do stuff all the time.
Yeah. How about you, Joseph? Do you agree?
Can you rephrase the question again one more time?
Well, I just ask if you believe that there are conspiracies in the world.
Oh, certainly. Like, to a lesser or greater extent, which of these are true, which of these aren't true, like that. It's not for me to say. It's for historical evidence to say, for eyewitness accounts to say. And, you know, like in every, like, historical perspective like that, you get different accounts. Like, one popular one, like, when I was in college, they had, it was like a 20th century European history class. And, you know, some people would debate, you know, was there a Fuhrer order for the final solution? Wasn't there a Fuhrer order for the final solution? At the end of the day, though, it's kind of a moot point, though, because at the end of the day, the Holocaust still happened. And because of it, you know, the debate, like, you know, did he give the specific order? You know, does any evidence remain like that? It doesn't matter very much because, you know, the end result is what it is. And that same thing with a lot of these conspiracies. you know, there's always questions for every type situation like that. And do I believe every last one of them? No. Is there compelling evidence for other ones that warrant a reinvestigation of things? Absolutely. And I'm totally open to that because, you know, if there really is nothing to hide, there, you know, shouldn't be any reason or any harm in investigating things like that. But what I tend to find is that when you go and actually look at, like, you know, what might these motivations for the so-called conspiracies be, it could be a disjoint and disunionized set of things that people are trying to project. Oh, well, this is this, that, and the other like that, when it might be simple as something as a personal motive or a financial motive or, you know, what have you like that. There's different motivations for these things. So are they possible? Yes. Are they prevalent? Could be. But really, ultimately, it relies on, like, without primary source evidence like that, I'm not going to believe much of anything because I'm the type of person that I need to see something visceral, you know, to verify these things.
Right, right. Well, and, you know, as you can clarify there already, there are people that are going to continue to question all these things, all of them, and that's a really good thing, I think. I think that, you know, I definitely agree with you when you said that we have to be able to examine and question, you know, history from both at our own pace and in our own way, but also from our own perspective, and be continue to be allowed to ask those questions again. Otherwise, we end up in the same authoritarian kind of point of view that it seems like then that the Illuminati were trying to break away from, and otherwise we're stuck with someone else dictating to us what reality is, but also how we should live our lives. And I think if people can have in common that non-aggression principle and just, you know, letting individuals be individuals, I think we've come a far and a long way in that process. But unfortunately, we are not there yet by any means at all. Anyway,
yeah.
Is there anything else you guys would like to leave us with for this time here? I mean, I've enjoyed the conversation very much. It's very interesting hearing about the documentation, hearing about what you think, you know, individually on top of it, so your own conclusions and stuff like that. And certainly, as always, there are, you know, 1,000 more questions. There are much more to talk about, and maybe we get an opportunity to do that, you know, at another time, of course. But let me ask you guys again here, in terms of where people can find more information, if there's nothing else you'd like to leave us with, where people know where to go to stay up to speed, and then also, obviously, where they might be able to pick up copies of the work eventually once it's published. Jiva, let's begin with you there.
All right. Well, of course, there is our blog, BavarianIlluminati.wordpress.com. And the translation of Philo's reply to questions concerning his association with the Illuminati is available at lulu.com, Amazon, pretty much anywhere where you can buy books. Not exactly sure when the ritual and doctrine is going to come out yet, but that should also be widely available.
All right, great. And of course, the links you mentioned at the end of the first segment there, we're going to have those linked up on redasscreations.com so people can click through easily from there. Same goes with your links, Joseph, but please again mention a few if you want to, and if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with.
Okay. Again, the IlluminatiJewel.com. That's a friend of mine. He makes those jewels. They're, you know, totally faithful reproductions. Like I mentioned before, there's two others in a museum in Germany. One of them's here in America. And this is a direct, exact copy of this particular jewel for the Minerva degree. Also, if you'd visit my friend Tom's website at IlluminatiRex.com, he does a pretty good job of kind of showing you what the degrees are. Now, he's still fine-tuning his cartoons, but to get like an idea of like what was going on there, you know, major points of the ritual like that, he pretty much has it all down there except for without the teachings and whatnot, which, of course, you can find later in our book. And other than that, I think that's pretty much it.
All right. Well, thanks to you both for your time today. Really appreciate it. It was a lot of interesting things that came out. So we'll say keep up the translations and the investigations till next time. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening today. I hope you gained some new perspective and insight on the Illuminati and have some new things to look into and consider. John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute is our next guest. We're going to talk about his book, A Government of Wolves, the Emerging American Police State. We'll speak to you in just a few days. In the meantime, we say thank you for listening and for being a member. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll speak to you in just a few days.